Good. Well, my name is Gareth Elwyn Jones, and before I retired, my last post before I retired was as Professor of Education and Dean of the Faculty of Education in the University College of Wales, Aberystwyth.
Thank you. Please, can you tell me about your own educational background and how you came into history teaching?
Really got involved in Welsh history, which I've specialised in all my career, when I was in grammar school in a place called Whitland in southwest Wales, Whitland, Carmarthenshire. Interesting school in that it was one of the schools founded under the Welsh Intermediate Education Act of the 1890s, which in itself was significant for a lot of things that happened very much later, and in fact is germane to what we're going to be talking about later in a way, because it was the first significant Act of Parliament which applied only to Wales to set up these schools. So education, apart from Sunday closing, which is not of anything like the same significance, it was a manifestation of growing Welsh self-confidence, I suppose, at the end of the 19th century. Anyway, when I was in Whitland, I wasn't terribly interested in anything except playing a great deal, as much cricket as I possibly could, and also playing as often as I could in the local billiard hall. But I began to feel a real love of history. Well, I suppose it was in the fifth and certainly in the sixth form. And I was very fortunate because I had a history teacher who was in his retirement years at that stage, but whose style of history teaching really I responded to very well. And he was, in fact, the father of William Matthias, the composer. His attitude towards history teaching was very modern in those days, because so much of what was going on in our grammar schools, which we tend to think as such marvellous institutions, was in fact just dictation of notes and rote learning. This man made us copy out all the notes to the summer back, and then we just spent our lessons discussing and arguing, and it was really an enormous encouragement. So then I went to Swansea University, and I met another person who had a far greater influence on my life, who'd just been appointed Professor of History, who in his later years became Sir Glanmore Williams, the one of the greatest of 20th century Welsh historians. And I became his student as an undergraduate, and then wrote a thesis which he supervised, and we knew each other and became great friends. And he had an enormous influence as well. And why this is relevant is that he took a considerable interest in school history teaching. And he became president of the Association of History Teachers in Wales, which had an influence on, and led the delegation to the Welsh office, which had an influence on, we don't know quite how much, in setting up the or getting through the establishment of a history committee for Wales. So his influence runs right through. From that there was only one career I was going into, and that was history teaching in some form or another.
So how did your ideas of teaching of history develop during your career at the Education Department in Swansea? Starting, I think, in 1972, is that right?
That's right, yes. But before that, I started my history teaching career in school. In 1963, and again, it's very interesting how individuals have such an impact on your life. I mean, I've been so fortunate in my teacher of history in school, then in my teacher of history at university, both of whom were very enlightened views. First on the history, on the way history should be taught, and second, in Glamour Williams's case, on the significance of Welsh history, which is what I was interested in. So I really felt lucky there. And then thirdly, on a marvellous chap who was my head of history in the school I taught in John Ruskin Grammar School in Croydon, which was my first appointment. And a man called Alan Murray was my head of department, a kind of cherubic Dickensian figure whose attitude to pupils and to the whole business of teaching history was so enlightened and really allowed me to get a view of history teaching which influenced me from that time on, and that it was about debate, discussion, argument and the rest of it. I wasn't there for very long. I was only there for 2 years before a job came up in Cardiff College of Education. I applied for that and got it, and joined an expanding department of history, which had jumped to 8 by the time I started. It was a very big department. I mean, there'd only been a couple of people in it. It was responding to the 1960s bulge and trend, and also to the fact that teaching degree was coming in, of course the BEd at that time, so they were expanding their staff. And that again, I was in a group of relatively young, new history lecturers who were all interested in the theory of history teaching, because obviously we were now teaching teachers of history. I was really thrown into the deep end. I mean, my own knowledge of it was relatively limited at that time, but we were into things like the new ideas about history teaching that were circulating at the time. John Fiennes, for example, had we didn't quite coincide because he left Cardiff College of Education just before I went there, but I mean, his reputation there was phenomenal. But we were in a group which was now actively involved in supervising students in junior schools, and actively involved in discussions all the time about children's thinking, and marrying really the education theory of the time with ideas about history teaching. So that was a very stimulating environment indeed. I think it was when I was in Cardiff that I actually got down and wrote a piece called Towards a Theory of History Teaching, which came out in History in, oh heavens, I don't know, sometime in the 1960s, which really sort of encapsulated the ideas that I had about history teaching at that time, and really worked on the basis that history was really about the way historians go about their work and not about the rote learning of facts and dates and all the rest of it, which was still in the secondary schools very prevalent at the time, and which I was just refusing to have from students, not only me but all my colleagues as well. And so I think that's the sort of background I've really gone on to later material there. So my ideas had developed before I went to Swansea, because I then went to Swansea College of Education to teach for 3 years. The same thing was happening there. So by the time I got to Swansea University Education Department in 1972, it was really more of the same, but the atmosphere was changing. That was the interesting thing, because not only did you have this sort of maelstrom of educational ideas about children's thinking, and I mean particularly Bruner's ideas on the spiral curriculum and this sort of thing, which I found very interesting and indeed seminal to the way I looked at the whole thing. But also there was a group developing in Swansea, in Wales, of young history teachers in the schools who were really a quite unique generation. And some of them are still around, many of them retired now, but they were reacting at grassroots level against much of the way history was still being taught. Because although we had the revolution going into comprehensive schools, the legacy of the grammar schools in many ways carried on, and there were a lot of people still regarding history as a subject which was a set of facts to be learned, and you learned opinions as well as facts by rote rather than by investigating the subject really as we looked at it. And this was epitomized in the O-level papers, because they were still in the WJEC, they were still the old five questions, five half-hour questions. And basically what people were doing was learning as much as they could about why Charles I was beheaded or something, and then just regurgitating it in half-hour chunks in the examination. And so there was a sort of grassroots rebellion against this whole ethos.
Why do you think that was happening at that time? Was it simply feeding through from the training colleges, or was it something else?
That I am not very sure of the answer to. There were some very bright history teachers around, many of whom, interestingly, were products of the Swansea History Department. Mm-hmm. And they were incredibly influential in producing a pressure group which could work at a variety of levels, because they had contacts with academics in the Swansea History Department, who themselves were converts to these ideas, and because they were prepared to put in the work. And they were the ones who founded the Association of History Teachers in Wales. Mm-hmm. And one was retired now, but was a very bright dynamic behind the association. Another is currently in HMI, another became advisor to Jane Davidson, the former minister in the Welsh Assembly government, and so on. I mean, they're still around, some of them still in post. They were the sort of young Turks, really, of the day. And they then, well, there's a whole series of events, I mean, which I won't go into because it's a long story. It's all been written up, incidentally, in a chapter which I can give you a reference to later on, by Paul, a chapter by Paul Jeremy and David Mannix, who are two of the most influential of these people. And David Mannix, of course, then initiated the production of a lot of resources. But what they did, and I think this is unique to Wales, because I don't think it happened in England. Well, certainly it didn't happen in England, because the whole ethos was different. See, they married the ideas they had to other sections of the of education in Wales. So they brought in, this was a grassroots movement among teachers who then enrolled people like myself in education, and people like Glamour Williams and Yaya Gwynedd Jones in academics in history, and that is why the Association of History Teachers in Wales became so influential, and why it revolutionized, perhaps too strong a word, but it certainly dramatically changed the nature of examining in Wales. Now, this wasn't happening in isolation, obviously. These ideas were going around in England as well, but there was a dynamic in Wales which took a different form. That, I think, is the point I would make.
And did you see changes in the style of exams in Wales then, even in the 70s, before GCSE came out in the 80s?
That I cannot categorically say, because basically I just don't remember at what point the old five questions were superseded by the more, you know, the lengthier questions on sources and so on. I don't know at what point that happened. I think the answer is yes, because it was being done at CSE level, and also at, I think, a unique Welsh qualification, the Certificate of Education as well, which was pioneered by David Maddox in Mid Glamorgan. And I think those were involving new approaches before the O-level papers changed. But I, off the top of my head, I don't remember the date that happened.
You mentioned sources. Was that part of the idea that students would start to think about alternative views of historical questions?
Yeah.
That was part of the idea, you had two sources.
Absolutely. I mean, essentially, it was this argument that history is not a monolithic series of facts and dates, but which of course there are, that is the scaffolding. Mm. But the whole interest of the subject is in seeing how those become an explanation of the events that took place, and that really relies on, as far as the professional historian is concerned, on taking a question and analysing as many as possible of the secondary and primary sources relevant to that particular question. And therefore, the argument went, and I believe this from the 1960s onwards, and that was really at the heart of this piece that I wrote in history, that all school teaching at whatever level should, all teaching history at whatever level, not only in schools but in colleges, universities and the rest of it, and the universities didn't by any means incorporate source materials into all their courses. I mean, obviously they did a special subject level, but I mean an awful lot of university teaching was, you know, standing up in front of a class giving a lecture. That was the opinion of the lecturer. You put it down on paper, you regurgitate it in the exam. So it was a broad spectrum really of discussion about what should happen. So given that the whole attraction of history for the professional historian was to look at these sources and then come up with explanations which best fitted the material that they were gleaning, then this should be reflected at all levels. Now, obviously, the younger the pupil, the greater had to be the element of guidance, and it had to all had to be attuned to the sophistication and basically to the thinking levels of the pupils at particular ages. But it should be reflected in all history teaching.
I'll just ask you about your interest in Welsh history, because all the schemes that were developed in England that reflected that progressive idea about history in schools, Council History Project, an AEB syllabus, yeah, Modern Work World, yeah, those were based around either broadly British, English or world ideas. Was there a Welsh history version of Schools History Project?
No. I mean, the Schools History Project was immensely influential. But again, there's another narrative that goes on side by side with all this in Wales, and that is the place of Welsh history in the schools anyway. Because in the in the old O-level papers, which were of course ubiquitous from, well, in terms of school certificate first of all, before the war, from 1917 on, right up to but certainly up until the time GCSE came in the 1980s, you had these five questions, one of which was starred, and you had to do it, and that was Welsh history. So Welsh history for an awful lot of teachers in Wales, for many of those decades, reflected the views of academics in the universities, really, that Welsh history was of relatively little significance. It was of marginal significance. There wasn't any real point in looking at basically what was a region of England as far as the as far as they were concerned. And the Welsh situation was equivocal, because there had been discussion right the way through the 20th century as to what constituted Welshness in the curriculum, and certainly history was regarded as a significant element of that, but it was so often just a bolt on, you know, oh heck, we've got to do a bit of Welsh history just so you lot can be be able to answer the one question. We'll spot a couple of questions and teach you a little bit about that. It wasn't integrated, it wasn't thought through. I mean, this isn't a blanket generalisation. Obviously, there were many teachers who, in my opinion, were enlightened and able to make sense of the place of Welsh history within the wider scheme of things. But of course, they were conditioned by academics' views as well. I mean, there's this lovely story in the 1940s of the review, I think it was in the Times Literary Supplement, of A.L. Rowse's book on Cornwell. This was a good as far as it goes, reading between the lines, Rowse should have been spending his time on something a great deal more worthwhile, because Cornwall was really one of those success stories of where a region had been incorporated into England. And essentially this was this kind of verdict that you had for historians who specialise in Welsh history. This then began to change from the 1950s on, as social history became much more significant, and a growing sense of nationhood as well, of whatever kind, cultural nationalism, whatever you like to think of it. And it gradually became almost a respectable occupation to be a Welsh historian. And again, Glamour Williams, the mentor who I mentioned, was very influential in doing this. His inaugural lecture was all about a justification for the study of Welsh history and how significant it was. And of course, this infused the thinking of the department over which he presided. And there were one or two who resented it greatly. But it was very difficult to get away from the fact that within a few decades, Welsh history had become a highly significant academic subject in its own right. So that was the other strand relating to this debate. It was a fight for changes in the way history was taught, but at the same time it impinged on the importance of Welsh history being well taught as well. And similar issues with different slants, and so marrying that became significant.
So teachers were looking around for Welsh sources in order to deal with that in the classroom.
Yeah, that was another point, of course, that there was that one has got to be sympathetic to teachers up until the the post-war period, because their secondary sources for the study of Welsh history were minimal. There's just a couple of textbooks which were available. Then, I mean, there was a breakthrough as far as sixth form history was concerned in 1950, the publication of David Williams' History of Modern Wales. And then, of course, it gradually improved after that. But we always run up against the problem. And again, this is a very long story, which I'll try and, I won't get into, but there is the problem that the market in Wales for school texts in Welsh history is not really profitable for British publishers. The big boys don't really want to know, quite honestly. And so there were two ways in which we tried to tackle this in the 1970s, 1980s, and that is the GCSE texts, for example, on Welsh history, were produced with a Welsh Office Education Department grant. And then a wonderful coup, a committee which had been set up through pressure from the AHTW and sympathy from the WJEC, the Welsh History Resources Committee. There you are, Wales working again. See, its chairman was Gladmore Williams, who bridged that sort of gap between the academic and the school situation. Their officer there managed to persuade Oxford to come in and sink a lot of money into producing a set of textbooks. So then a lot of work was being done on an ad hoc basis at county level. Middle Morgan in particular was the shining light here, producing sets of documents and the rest of it. They managed to, there was a lot of lobbying of television companies, and HTV, I think it was, at that time, what was it, ITV Wales, I can't remember, put on a wonderful series of programmes called The Dragon Has Two Tongues, which had its hilarious moments because it pitted a wonderful broadcaster, Winfred Vaughan Thomas, who was no historian, but a brilliant broadcaster, against one of Wales's outstanding characters, Gwynalf Williams, who was a Marxist historian, an absolute live wire. And there were some classic moments in that. But the supplement to that was they produced a whole series of documents, reproductions of documents, which were made available to schools. So at all kinds of levels, there were activities building up in the 70s, the 80s, and the 90s.
Thank you. Can we come now to the national curriculum? And I wanted to ask you how you came to be a member of both the National Curriculum English History Working Group and the History Committee for Wales.
Well, I suppose the facile answer to that is that I got a phone call from the Welsh office. From a chap called Martin Evans, who was a marvellous character, he asked me to go to Cardiff for an interview, and I can't remember the words exactly of what he said, but the interview turned out to be with Wynne Roberts, who was the Minister of State, now Lord Roberts of Conwy, who was the Minister of State responsible for education at the time. But if you're asking me to read between the lines, and I've no evidence whatsoever for this, this is utterly unhistorical.
Reason, sir.
I was, yes. So, the way these things is are done is very mysterious. You pick up bits of information. I don't know. There was a difference, I do know, in the mechanics of appointing the History Working Group and the History Committee for Wales. The History Working Group members were, to the best of my knowledge, certainly the majority of them were interviewed either by Baker, Kenneth Baker, or by Angela Rumbold and Kenneth Baker, or Angela Rumbold herself. One, at least, who was interviewed, there is significant evidence, was turned down by Thatcher. And because of a belief that the person concerned was too much involved in the new history. The other influence that apparently she had was that there weren't enough academic historians on the History Working Group. And whether this was the reason that John Roberts was appointed or not, I don't know. But even afterwards, the accusation was made that there were too many educationalists on it and not enough historians. And that John Roberts was the only historian, which John Roberts was streets ahead of me as a historian, but I had written two history books at that stage, but there we are. It slightly irked me, but I was dubbed with the education brush. So that was done on an interview basis, except for me. And I think this was all to do with negotiations or infighting, negotiations, call it by whatever term you like, manipulation. This all stems from the fact that there was a History Committee for Wales at all, because this was unique. There wasn't a committee in any other subject. Obviously, as far as Welsh was concerned, there was no equivalent in England. So that was straightforward. But the only other subject in which there was anything other than one sort of token Welsh representative was history. And it is an extremely interesting story in its own right, because it would appear that the Association of History Teachers in Wales, which was phenomenally influential just at that time, was sufficiently well thought of in the Welsh Office Education Department for them to receive a delegation from the AHTW, four of us, Glamour Williams in the lead. And remember, he is now one of the probably the preeminent Welsh historian of his time, an eminent public servant, absolutely regarded as a safe pair of hands right the way through, former chairman of the BBC in Wales and so on. So they wouldn't have received that delegation, it seems to me, unless they were going to be reasonably receptive to the request for some kind of separate treatment for Wales. The basis being that you can't have a history working group which is going to devise a history curriculum for Welsh schools where Welsh history is going to be so significant. Their perspective is obviously, and their priorities are obviously going to be different from those in Wales. That was the sort of gist of the thing. So personalities came into it, I think, probably, in a big way. Now, Roger Hennessy, who was, I suspect, highly the chief HMI for history, who I was, I think, senior inspector he was, was very influential, I think, in drawing up the membership of the group and in recommending people. Now, Roger and I had met at an AHTW conference in Llandrindod, where he was the guest speaker, not long before this, and I'd got on very well with him. I mean, that, I think, is probably the way in which an awful lot of this was done. So I was acceptable to Roger. I was involved in the Association of History Teachers in Wales as the teacher training representative. I'd written some stuff on the teaching of history. I jointly edited a book called New History, All Problems, which had involved some of the teachers in Wales and had dealt with this whole business of the way in which history should be taught. So, and I knew, again, most of it. Gladwell Williams was very well known. In fact, they were great friends. The chief inspector, Ishtyn Lloyd, in Wales, and Glan were very big buddies. So I suspect that questions were asked all the way along the line, you know, is this bloke likely to rock the boat? Because, I mean, potentially, it could have been dynamite right the way through. I mean, I was quite innocent in all this. I mean, I didn't know what I was letting myself in for at all. It's only in retrospect I realised just how wrong things could have gone. Because you're saying this is a unique arrangement. You're saying these two committees have got to work together, and yet the one occupies a kind of superior position to the other. You know, how are we going to cope? The other thing was that they appointed Rhys Davies, who was then not only Professor of History in Aberystwyth, but Pro Vice Chancellor in Aberystwyth, or Vice Principal, I suppose he was then, in Aberystwyth as well, who was a historian of international distinction, and also regarded as absolutely balanced and first. I mean, he was actually interviewed in connection with, so I'm told, interviewed in connection with taking on the chairmanship of both groups, and said that he couldn't possibly do that. He didn't have the time. And the one big contribution I think I have made to Welsh history is that Rhys did actually talk to me about the workload. He said, I can't, this is in relation to the History Committee for Wales. He said, I can't possibly do this. I haven't got enough time to do it. I said, Rhys, you must do it. It's going to be so important. Now, I don't know how much influence I have, but I did know him very well. He was a great friend, and he was superb. So I think it was partly to do with the things I'd done formally, but also partly because of knowing or being acquainted with the relevant people and being regarded as relatively sane.
And say your new history credentials didn't get in the way, obviously.
No, interestingly enough, that's a question that I hadn't thought of. What I don't know is the process whereby my name came up in the first place. I mean, I imagine what happened is that the History Committee for Wales thought this chap might fit the bill, and then Roger Hennessy okayed it. But I mean, I was the only one who didn't see either Baker or Rumble to be cross-examined about my views, because Wynne Roberts was great. I mean, he just put the questions to me that the principal had prepared for him, and we got on fine.
What sort of questions did they ask you?
Why, basically sort of biographical questions, you know. I don't recollect about my career and my interests and all the rest of it. I don't recollect that any question of the new history or I think they did ask about the relationship between the two groups, and would I feel comfortable about being involved in drawing up a curriculum which would be relevant to places outside Wales and so on. I think they asked about that, but I really don't remember a great deal about that. No.
And the two groups then had slightly the same remit to a certain extent. The Welsh group had to follow the History Working Group and then develop a separate content. Is that right?
Absolutely, yes. As Rhys always used to say, I mean, we were We had one hand tied behind our backs to start with, the History Committee for Wales, because the whatever we came up with had to fit, as in England, with the TGAD report, you know, Black's report, which had this incredibly complex structure of assessment of 10 levels of attainment, and within that profiles and statements of attainment and so on, right through the various levels, going up from 5 to 16 at that stage. Because, I mean, nobody actually thought at that stage what the relationship between the national curriculum and GCSE was going to be. So we went, had to do the whole lot right the way through. Now, theoretically, as far as I understand it, it was the history working group which was responsible for drawing those up within the national curriculum, and that would have to apply and would, if necessary, have to be imposed on the Welsh group. There was no leeway, as far as I am aware, for the Welsh group to draw up its own statements of attainment. And of course it would have been nonsense for it to do so, because the whole structure of the statements of attainment was on a progressive development of historical understanding and skills. Well, the basis of the subject must be common to the subject pretty well globally. It's only the questions that you ask and the questions you work on which can be different. So that was a potential minefield, because what if the History Working Group drew up a set of attainment targets, levels of attainment, and then, you know, sort of sent them down to the Welsh Office Education Department and said, right, get on with it. You know, I mean, we were all, the Welsh group, were all involved in history teaching of some form or another, and there were some very bright people involved right across the spectrum, from infant school, junior school, secondary school, teacher education, BBC Education Department, WJEC, and academics. So, I mean, there was no way we were going to be just sort of steamrolled into accepting everything that was imposed on us. It could have been a disaster, but fortunately, as you say, the only remit that the History Committee for Wales had was to devise the content, which would then rest on the statements of attainment in the History Working Group. But fortunately, and this is where again individual dynamics, group dynamics become so crucial, the chairman of the History Working Group, Michael Saunders Watson, got on famously with Rhys Davies. The management committees did, in other words, there were three, I think, on each side, who we used to meet from time to time as well. And we hammered everything out perfectly acceptably between us, because Michael always asked, now what's the thinking of HWG on this? And occasionally, so the statements, as I remember, were the whole assessment structure was originated with the HWG, and then was there for discussion, but not just endorsement, modification as well, back to HWG from HCW, and we agreed on a common assessment structure with all the statements and all the rest of it.
Did that happen much, that the HCW made changes that then were referred back to the...
I think changes of phraseology, one or two changes, particularly at the bottom end. Yeah, absolutely, were accepted.
Now, you had that unique role, didn't you, as a go-between the two groups.
I did.
How was it supposed to work in theory, and did it work out in practice?
When I started, I didn't have a clue as to how it was going to work in theory. I found out at the first meeting of the HWG. First of all, HWG started work before the History Committee for Wales. I've got a feeling, was it in January we had our first, very early in January, we had our first meeting of the History Working Group. And I think the first meeting of the History Committee for Wales was in February. So there was a little bit of a time lag while we started working a lot of things out. So the early meetings, there was no input from HCW, the first couple of meetings. Then once HCW had started meeting, I suddenly realised, nobody told me this, that I was expected to deliver a report as the first item on the agenda, first or second item on the agenda, at every History Working Group meeting. So, I mean, the first meeting, I was lost, I didn't prepare anything. But after that, I made sure that all of the discussions of the HCW were reported at length to the History Working Group, and vice versa. But it was more, it was less formal in HCW, the reporting back, and very often it was done relatively informally by a group of, just sort of getting together and saying, this is what we talked about, and all the rest of it, and then just making a formal report at the HCW meeting. Then, of course, all the papers were interchanged between the groups. Although I did just pick up on one or two occasions that the papers were a very long time coming. And I just got the impression that the amity and the very, very good relations that we had as members of the groups were not always reflected at civil service level. But that may be quite erroneous. I just got this feeling from time to time that the papers perhaps were not quite as prompt as they might have been now and again.
So you had Welsh Office civil servants attending the HCW?
Oh, yes.
And
yes.
HMIs from Wales?
Yeah, HMI, yeah. Sorry, I should have mentioned that when I was saying the constitution of the group. Yes, we had the one of the two history HMIs in Wales, Owen Jones. He was at the History Committee for Wales.
Were they quite influential in the discussions or not?
Oh, they were very significant. Of course, I should have said things come back to you during an interview, don't they? Of course, that was another thing. HMI were extremely influential and probably extremely influential in deciding on who the group members should be. I strongly suspect they were. Certainly Roger was in England, and I'm pretty sure that Owen Jones was in Wales. Now Owen and I, of course, had worked together at Cardiff College of Education. This is the typical sort of Welsh way, you know, wheels within wheels within wheels. Everybody knows each other, and it's a great, now again it can be a weakness, but it's a great strength as well, because things can be discussed less formally sometimes. But to answer the question seriously, HMI in both groups were very influential. Roger in particular, I think in England, was very conscious of the pitfalls. Owen didn't need to be quite as conscious of the pitfalls because he had a much easier wicket to bat on.
I wanted to ask you what the special considerations were that the History Committee of Wales had in mind when devising the Welsh National Curriculum. What sort of special ideas did they have?
Well, I'm not sure that there were any unique ideas that emanated from Wales. What we had to do was to draw up content. But of course that content had to be justified, and so statements had to be made about the nature of Welsh history, the reasons for the teaching of Welsh history. There was a, you know, that was a kind of almost an essay really on the place of Welsh history in schools and a little bit about its history and so on, as you will have seen from the report. And Rhys came up with this notion of the map of Welsh history with the contours and so on. It was a metaphor that I think sustained thinking right the way through. Obviously the main discussion was a similar kind of discussion to the one that occupied us a lot in the History Working Group, and that is, well, what is significant in Welsh history? You know, what are the significant periods? How might we divide them up? Within those periods, what are significant events? And of course, it was different content, but same kinds of considerations. And once you get into this, of course, I mean, you begin to debate historical significance. And, you know, should this be involved? What view of history does this give to, do we have that we want to give to our children, that we want our children to have in contemporary Wales and so on? You know, they're enormous questions, but they're in one way sort of routine questions, aren't they? To any group in any country wanting to draw up the kind of content that they want to transmit. Because, I mean, there wasn't any, the whole raison d'etre of the History Committee for Wales was that we were there to draw up content. We didn't have any say in that. That was what we were told to do. So it wasn't a case of the HCW saying, well, we don't agree with any specified content. There should be a free-for-all, because, you know, we could have gone home after the first 5 minutes. That was the constraint under which we operated.
I wonder whether there was an agreed canon in terms of Welsh history, as opposed to, in the History Working Group, a great deal of debate about what should go in and what should be left out. I wondered if there was more natural agreement on the significant events of Welsh history amongst the HCW.
Well, I think the answer to that is probably yes and no. In one sense, because there was no political independence in Wales between 1282, and even then it's a different kind of political independence, and 1999. At the time, obviously, in 1989, obviously there was no devolution settlement and so on. So because of that, Welsh history becomes much more a history of a particular society, and how that society is structured and how it occupies its time, how it evolves and all the rest of it. So in that sense it was less contentious, because we hadn't taken into account these awful problems like imperialism and, you know, relationships and exploitation and all that. Because the Welsh weren't in a position to exploit anybody. But you put a group of historians together in whatever context and ask them what what should be included in the history of Swansea, for example. And you have as many opinions as you've got as historians. So the debate never stopped. But it was easier, yes. I mean, we didn't have the sort of pressures on us that they did in England. Excuse me, can we stop just a second? Are we on again?
No, not yet.
In terms of limits set on the power of HCW, there weren't any, not in terms of its content.
Right. So you could have gone for a completely Welsh curriculum and no mention of England at all?
Well, I suppose in theory we could, but that would have been so unhistorical that, well, I'm sure Rhys Davies would never have countenanced it, and I don't think anybody else in the group would have. You know, you've got to see Wales, obviously, It would be utterly ludicrous to look at the history of Wales in isolation from that of England. It just wouldn't be possible. And then there's a whole question of Welsh colonies, for example, that grew up.
But you did feel there was it wasn't so difficult to get an agreement on the Welsh perspective.
No, because, well, for one thing, we didn't have the political pressures.
That brings me on to your article in 2000, entitled "The Debate Over the National Curriculum for History in Wales: The Role of the Press." Can you recall how you felt at the time when the History Working Group was at the centre of press attention?
Hoping that the phone wouldn't ring, because I didn't want to know. We were advised at the beginning, very sensibly, that press inquiries, this was going to be contentious, press inquiries would be taken by the DES. And that we would be best advised not to give interviews. Well, I stuck with that all the way through.
And were you affected by what was being printed in the papers?
Not really, because although we were given press cuttings, I can't remember whether I read the whole lot at the time. I certainly read them all later, but no, I knew what I mean. So much of what was happening in the press was polemic, and it was very easy not to be influenced by it. An awful lot of it was just rubbish, so you weren't influenced by that. And where you did have nice, sensible people commenting on what you were doing and saying what a good job you did, you thought, oh, that's great anyway.
Did the press coverage affect the HCW at all?
Well, now that's that really is an interesting question, because compared with all the stuff that appeared in England, very, very little appeared in Wales. There wasn't anything like the interest. There are some very interesting insights into this, you see. As far as the London press was concerned, as far as the London papers were concerned, they didn't want to know. I don't recall anything in the London dailies or broadsheets the weekend press that really had any reference to Wales. I think we might just as well have been operating in a vacuum as far as they were concerned. Nobody bothered. I mean, that really does, it seems to me, sum up the whole attitude of London to anything outside, you know, the Watford Gap one way or Reading the other direction. I'm trying to think, in the Times Ed even, which there was a lot of pressure going on in the Times Ed in those days to try and get it a bit more Welsh. Which has only happened, incidentally, since devolution. Although still most of it is telling us about legislation that doesn't affect us, but there we are. I'm sorry, I shouldn't make remarks like that. The Times Ed report that I can remember, and it may be that it's just that I remember the nonsense, gave a completely garbled account of what the History Committee for Wales was doing and what the influences on it were. And Rhys Davies had to write a refutation. So, you know, as far as that side of things are concerned. Now, as far as the Welsh press were concerned, the Western Mail did do the odd piece on it, nothing contentious. A Welsh language magazine called Golwg, I remember, did ring me up, and I gave a very, very guarded response about what was going on. There was no real onslaught or attempt to influence the group in the way that there was in England.
That's interesting, because you'd suspect that there would be people with agendas to how the history curriculum for Wales present a certain view of its relationship with England?
Yes, oddly enough, I think probably the more pressing question would have been how much Welsh history, from a minority of history teachers, how much Welsh history will we be forced to teach? I suspect that is more likely than that there was any real contention about what should be included. I mean, I don't really recall anything equivalent to the sort of debate that was going on in England.
What was your view about the contributions of professional historians to the debate about content?
It's interesting, again, in Wales, the professional historians have been brought on board. So we had no opposition from the professional historians. They weren't undermining or attacking in any way at all. All of those who've been interested in the school teaching debate, and I mean that's not that many of them, and similarly in England, but the ones who were on side, very supportive, realised that probably what we were trying to do was going to benefit the cause of Welsh history rather than in any way undermine it. What did I think of what was going on in England? There were two groups, weren't there? There were people like Keith Robbins, who at the time was president of the Historical Association, who I knew anyway, and he was moderation itself, and very supportive, and realised that we were trying to do a very difficult job in very difficult circumstances. Then, of course, you had the others, the other professional historians, like the history, the people who joined the History Curriculum Association. Not sure I can remember them. Max Beloff was one, I think. Robert Skidelsky, Geoffrey Elton. You know, these are big hitters. John Vincent wrote a very strange piece. Which was really it was difficult to cope with because it was a scattergun approach. So I mean, as far as I was concerned, I wasn't particularly influenced in my thinking, because the final report, the interim report and the final report, roughly reflected the way in which I thought history should be taught anyway. I could never take on board those professional historians who were determined to involve content in the assessment process because it was illogical, it couldn't be done on the black formula. Content could not logically be built into the attainment targets. So that was something that I wasn't that influenced by. Obviously one could see where some of the people, people like, was it Freeman, and who was the other chap from Lewis?
McGovern,
Chris McGovern. You could see where they were coming from. And I did have very strong views about some of the dilution that had taken place in the teaching of history. I could never believe that a humanities program could be a substitute for proper history teaching. I was very skeptical of programs like Man in Society, I think it was, which was an attempt to combine the various programs in various subjects. So, I mean, I sympathise very much with that, but once we were granted the fact that history was to be a discrete subject, which was obviously at the premise on which we were working anyway, then I was very much in sympathy with the approach that that we took, and therefore it was not difficult to be relatively neutral towards the kinds of comments that were taking place. And then if you go into the third category, the journalists, I mean, they varied from the, of course, there were other historians like Raphael Samuel, who were very moderate in what they were saying, and really exposed, I think I said this in the article, really exposed the paucity of or the shallowness of any Labour thinking. And so we had the conservative right-wing extremist view crying out to be refuted, and nothing being coming from the other side until very late on and very feebly. So we were a group of professional historians and educators who were relatively easily convinced that there was only one structure which could come out of this. In terms of what that content should be, then obviously we did all have our own agendas, because we had our own views of British society and so on. But many of these were uncontentious, again, not taking too much notice of some of the polemics that were going on. I mean, the history working group, we were all convinced, I think, that we should all take on board the fact that Great Britain should be the history of, or United Kingdom rather, should be the history of four countries, and not just that of England, which was fascinating. One thing I always did like noticing in the press was the complete confusion, even among professional historians, between England and Britain, and England and the United Kingdom. For England, read, for the United Kingdom, read England.
I just wondered whether you had representations from Welsh history teachers, or did it all come through the Association of History Teachers in Wales?
No, there was a separate consultation in Wales, and that all came through the Welsh Office Education Department. Each member of the group had exactly the same procedure. At least 2 members of the group read every representation, but I don't think there was anything like the volume of what came through in Wales. Interestingly, you know, you were saying that the that you couldn't lay hands on the responses in England. They disappeared in Wales as well. Don't know where they are.
That's interesting. You referred now just now to this difficulty over defining UK, Britain, four countries, and in fact you said in the article there's an underlying unease about the status and nature of the relationships between those nations. Why was that the case in 1989? What was the problem there?
That's an enormous question. But I think there was beginning to be a realization, probably from the 60s on, that British history, here I'm doing it now, United Kingdom history, was not just about English kings and queens. That you had four nations with different histories. Is it archipelagic history, I think, was becoming significant, which really is just a shorthand for a realization that, you know, Britain, United Kingdom, made up of very complex patterns of relationships between the various countries. There was a growing literature. Rhys Davies himself had written a wonderful book on the medieval background to this. I don't remember the exact dates when they were published, but people like Norman Davies were writing. Linda Colley, of course, wrote a very influential book on this kind of topic. So you had that kind of measured historic professional historian's approach combined with the kind of populist press and rather more glib historians who were, and the politicians as well, who were saying that, you know, the history curriculum must reproduce the essential elements of Britishness, Englishness, whatever, British values, English values, and so on, that if they don't do this, then they're not fulfilling their function of passing on the essential heritage of the nation. But what was the nation? That was the problem, because the perception of the nation in a history working group, by definition, is different from the history, from the perception of the nation in the History Committee for Wales. Now, Wales didn't have that problem, because, I mean, you can go on arguing about which bits are Welsh and so on, and what constitutes Welshness, you know, language, culture, geography, whatever. But they're not as acerbic as they were just at the time of the history working group. I mean, I suppose basically, you know, this goes back to a realization before this that Britain was no longer top dog in the world, that the empire had disappeared, that we'd won the war and bankrupted ourselves in the process, and where what part we were going to play at top table and all the rest of it. And so there was this residual element which was underlying a lot of the debate about Britain's greatness and Britain's superiority in the world over everybody else, and so on. So I think there was, well, it was part, it was an unease. I mean, it was a profound difference of opinion and difference of perspective, which didn't give rise to the same kind of polemic in Wales, and didn't go so far in undermining. Well, in fact, I mean, you know, what, how on earth can you argue, you know, what on earth are Welsh values anyway? You know, what the question, the perspective is different in Wales. So I think you couldn't put everything in the content of what the History Working Group was doing. By selecting, you were making political statements. If you selected kings and queens, if you selected trade unions, if you selected a syllabus consisting only of men, or the opposite, consisting only of women, if you left out certain social groups, everything was a precarious tightrope. So we came up very early on with this notion of political, economic, social, and cultural, which was, you know, all encompassing. But then, this was combined, of course, with the unease, which is a different kind of unease altogether, as to how much content should be prescribed anyway, which is an entirely different debate, but revolved around the same thing. You know, Mrs. Thatcher wanted a particular view of British history to be passed on, echoing certain ideas that she had about Britain's greatness and what constituted Britishness and British values and all the rest of it.
That was not explicitly stated, presume. It was an assumed thing, or?
Well, as far as I know, it wasn't explicitly stated, but it was the group was certainly aware after the publication of the interim report that certain things were required and certain things weren't being done.
Okay. Were you particularly affected by that, ill at ease about it, or were you okay with it because of the Welsh perspective?
No, I mean, the one... There's a difference between the report and the content. The report, I was quite convinced about from the start, and I think the majority on each group and all the Welsh group were convinced that you couldn't, this was the big debate, was the assessment of content. The government made it clear, I can't remember whether it was explicit or implicit, that content should be assessed. She rejected the interim report on that basis, or rather, it was delayed. The final report, as you know, was delayed even more because the content that was specified under those four headings was not going to be assessed. Many of us argued very, very vigorously that it was absolutely impossible to assess content. Nobody had come up with any kind of logical structure by which you could assess factual information in a progressive way. You know, what's the difference between level one knowledge and level five knowledge, and so on. So that was the basic issue, which was the one that was fought over right the way through. And this is where, again, the London press had no idea of how significant the History Committee for Wales was in supporting the History Working Group on this particular stance, because the report was there right the way through. Everybody agreed that it couldn't be done. Nobody could come up with any formula by which it could be done. Therefore, it had to be left out.
But then the study units, which did prescribe content.
Yes.
Those, as you say, there were certain values and ideas that the government wanted included. Were those ones that you could live with from a Welsh perspective?
I think so. I mean, I don't remember disagreeing violently with the inclusion of anything that was there. I think there was a reasonable amount of notice taken of the United Kingdom involving Northern Ireland, Scotland, and Wales. There were examples there included. There were examples of the imperial past and so on. There were examples of the significance of great women in history, as well as great men. And there were significant examples of working class history to go alongside with to go alongside of you know, your royal courts. So I didn't have any profound disagreement about that. I did. The one example of real political pressure that came in, of course, was over the Second World War on the Holocaust, which is a position I maintain until now, and that is that I don't myself believe that younger pupils, the pupils below the age of certainly 16, probably arguably university age, should study the history of the Holocaust, because it can either be superficial and therefore demeaning to the whole historical significance of it, the appalling human significance of it, or it can be extremely upsetting because of the nature of the evidence that people, to which people are subjected, and then the sheer awfulness of what happened. And so I remember arguing that at the time the interim report, it shouldn't be there. And of course, this got Parliament up in arms, and of course it was included. But I've been asked about this on a number of occasions since, and I stick to my view. How far that means leaving out elements of the Second World War, I don't know. But that was just an idea. I mean, that wasn't the kind of disagreement which made me think, oh, well, I can't be part of this. I mean, because there were arguments on both sides.
One of the issues that you mentioned in your article was about national identity. You said it's at the heart of the debate about the national curriculum in both Wales and England. Was that discussed at all explicitly in the meetings of either committee?
I don't think explicitly, no. I really don't remember, in the sense that there were no discussions there that made a very profound impact on me in terms of those. It's easier to answer the History Committee of Wales, because it was the concept of a Welsh national identity that had given rise to the committee in the first place. So there was going to be no debate about whether whether there's a Wales or not, and whether we can have a curriculum or not. Has Wales got a history? Of course it has, that's why we're here. I don't think there was any discussion really about whether there should be a quote British or United Kingdom national history. There were certainly debates about what should be included and how it should be balanced, and if you include this, should you include that? Now, you know, there's nothing here about the influence of the Scottish Enlightenment, let us say, as opposed to something else. Shouldn't we put that in, and so on? So it was that kind of debate, I think. I don't think there were I don't recall, anyway, being involved in any profound debates about how far, about whether there was an identity which encompassed the British Isles.
But the discussions that you had about content and the political context of those discussions with the press interest, etc., were those what you meant by a reference to national identity being fundamental to the discussion?
What I really, I think, meant was that what I was referring to earlier, as far as the History Working Group was concerned, that there were certain pressures coming from the politicians and the press, which we were aware of, that argued that there should be certain kinds of interpretations reflected in the content of the heritage and the values of the people who were making that case. Now, the problem was that I think most of the people on the group, if not all of them, realized that history is a very broad church. It is not just about reflecting particular views of sections of the population, however influential they might have been. There are as many interpretations of what is significant in the history of the United Kingdom as there are people grouped round the table. So in that sense, it was a view of what constituted national history that was at the core of all our discussions, because what is historically significant?
For the whole community.
For the whole community, from the perspective of a group looking at the history of the United Kingdom. The answers are going to be different, obviously, for a group looking at the history of France, or a group looking at it from the history of Wales, because precisely the same discussions occurred in Wales. Not because there you were questioning whether there was a national identity, as I was trying to say earlier, But because the Sami put a group of Welsh historians together, they will say, well, yes, I mean, obviously, what happened in 1536, the Act of Union, was crucial. You'd probably get agreement about that. You might get about the Bible, for example, in 1588. But a lot of other people, I would argue, for example, that the sporting history of Wales has been profoundly significant over the 20th century, and that there are certain notions of national heroes who are reflected in that sporting ethos, who actually have an impact on the national psyche. People like Gareth Edwards, for example. So, I mean, he ought to be in there somewhere. But I'm trying to take a sort of extreme example, but it's not an entirely facetious example either. Now, others might disagree, compared with the history of music in Wales, for example, sport is of far less significance, or certainly many would argue that compared with the history of religion in Wales, these are sort of second division subjects. So that's the kind of thing I was referring to, that the notion of what constitutes Welshness is going to differ and is going to be the subject of endless debate, but not that there is a Wales to record the history of.
If you talk about the history working group in England, was there a notion of Englishness that was underpinning the discussion?
I knew you were going to ask me that. And the answer is, I think, not. But that would be my gloss on it, and I'm coming from a different perspective from many other people. There was certainly a concept, I think, that certain things in the history of England were of enormous significance. Magna Carta, Norman invasions, Industrial Revolution, whatever. Those things are of enormous significance in the history of England. There are certain things that are significant in the history of England in relation to the four, the other three countries of the United Kingdom, and therefore that ought to be reflected. There are certain people who are particularly influential, and so on and so on. So it's that. In one sense, the one is implicit in the other, isn't it? I don't recall us going in and saying, well, right, now let's see if we can define Englishness, and let's see if we can reflect this in the curriculum. You're there, you're trying to devise a curriculum with England, in a way, I suppose, at its core, but not the overarching centerpiece of the whole. And yet, I can see the point.
Because you implied that the job of the history working group was more difficult than for the group in Wales. Part of that was about the political context and the press interest. But I wondered whether there was a fundamental lack of certainty at the core of what people were doing in the History Working Group as opposed to the History Committee for Wales about this issue of what exactly informed the notion of national identity that was going to pull together the significant issues from the history of the nation.
I think I can only answer it from another point of view, and that is that in both we were going in with certain preconceived notions ourselves of what constituted Wales, what constituted England, and what constituted the United Kingdom. We were all historians or had a historical training of some kind. We all had a view and all those views were different of what the essential elements in that history were. I think what we were then looking, what the debate was about, was how far these were reflected in the ideas we had over the whole chronological framework that we eventually devised. I don't think it was a top-down thing. I think it was a bottom-up thing. You're working almost from a different kind of perspective, and a much more messy one in a way, because I mean, arguably, if you've gone in with, you know, Englishness consists of the following six things, you'd have had a very simple curriculum. But of course, that would have ignored the chronology. It would have ignored completely the development of the historical discipline over the years since the war, because you'd have all these changes in historical emphasis. I mean, if this curriculum had been drawn up in the 1920s, it would have been a very, very different one from the coming that was drawn up in the 1980s. And this, of course, is what many of the diehards objected to. You know, that you wanted to take full cognition of the contribution which some of the racial minorities had made to the history of Britain over the centuries. And so that needed to be reflected in the curriculum. So it was, in a way, a view of history, which was the result of our historical training, which was then reflected in what we believe to be the significant milestones in the history of Britain.
Thank you. So were you happy with both the reports, the History Working Group and the History Committee for Wales?
Yes. I thought the marriage of the education... Sorry, let me go back on that. I never believed that one of the fundamental building blocks of the report could work, and that is the assessment structure. It was too complex, it was too unwieldy, it was built not for external assessment but for teacher assessment, and even then would be impossible to cope with for the majority of teachers. It developed, as we all, as many of us in education said it would, into a tick box culture, and it was crazy. It shouldn't. To be fair to Professor Black, I don't think he ever intended it to do the job that it was later forced to do. So from that point of view, it's certainly not the structure that I would have wanted in a report. But that was a given. We had no choice. We therefore had to construct a curriculum on the basis of that, and I think, I mean, you know, obviously I would, wouldn't I, that we did a very good job in marrying the general sort of approach of the attainment targets, particularly things like historical understanding, interpretations of history was a crucial one. And I remember Alice Prohaska arguing very, very strongly in favour of this, because we were beginning to think that the whole thing was getting too complex, and she said, this is the guarantee that you'll get different views of history put through. And she was absolutely right. So I think all those, you know, I think the attainment targets and the notion of the assessment of skills through an assessment of understanding through factual information, because obviously this always seemed to me the nonsense of the whole thing. You cannot have an exercise in history without some content. You've got to be able to, you've got to have something you're working on. So therefore, they, you know, you're going to learn a lot of history along the way if you're going to get anywhere with the attainment targets. But I think given the structure that we had to work with, we did a very good job. And I think the notion of marrying the progression embodied in a kind of Brunnerian spiral curriculum with the attainment targets was a particularly important one. I think the negotiation of what was an absolute minefield as far as the History Working Group was concerned was done extremely carefully, and I think bravely, because the pressures at various stages, first through the civil servants and then through the politicians on Michael Saunders Watson, were very, very significant indeed. And he never caved it. He was convinced by the argument. From that point of view, he was a wonderful chairman, because you could argue a case, and if he believed it, he would take it on board and he would stick to it. And he resisted pressure, as you know, right the way up through to Thatcher level. So I think from that point of view, the group has got to be a lot to be proud of. And the Welsh group, I think, produced, in less contentious circumstances, a very interesting report indeed.
So, looking back over the 20 years since the national curriculum was introduced in Wales and in England, what are your views about the impact it's had on the teaching of history? Big question.
Oh dear. Well, when you think of the debate that's going on at the moment in the Historical Association and so on about the way in which history is being devalued in the secondary school, you begin to despair about I wouldn't do it again, and that history, the discussions that we had in those two groups were as challenging and as interesting intellectually as anything I've ever been involved in my life. They were fascinating, and they were wonderful groups of people to work with. So if the whole thing had crumbled like a house of cards at the end, I wouldn't have minded. It was just good to be involved. I think the debate that was raging at the time has died down, and I think that the reports made some significant contribution to that. I don't think people are now getting het up in the same way about the skills content confrontation, which was always a ridiculous one anyway. Now, having said that, of course, as you know, as soon as the report was produced, everything started being diluted. First of all, the assessment structures. We were never going to get our 3 hours a week anyway, which we were promised. That was pie in the sky, as it turned out. It wasn't very long before Margaret Thatcher, who'd only wanted a core curriculum anyway, got more or less what she wanted, because you had, literacy hours and numeracy hours and so on, and, primary schools back to teaching the core subjects all the morning, and then a little bit of gloss in the afternoon, you could do a little bit of other stuff that's in the national curriculum. It is still there. It is still part of the curriculum in Wales and in England, but at GCSE levels, numbers are apparently I think the main threat is the Key Stage 3 problem, isn't it? Where the time is just being whittled away, as I understand it, and many schools are still not now doing any history at all, or certainly not as a discrete subject. It's all bundled up into the old humanities programs, which we were fighting against way back in the 19, or some of us were fighting against way back in the 1960s. So, the dilution started with Deering, was it in 1993? And there have been various revisions of the curriculum since. But the some of the structures that are associated with the reports are still there. the statements of attainment and so on, and the notion of attainment targets, which are still the same. And that's fine. I wouldn't have wanted in any case originally to have as much content in those reports as was included. But I do think that there ought to be some statement still of a broad entitlement of pupils at all levels, not for the 5 to 7s as we were perhaps forced into. That's been superseded in any case in Wales by the foundation phase, which is very exciting and a reversion to good practice from the old notion. Getting a dry throat here. No historical document's going to last for very, you know, it's going to have that profound influence, an influence for very long anyway. I think it was important in the debates. I think there are now different battles to be fought. And we've got to go back almost to questions that were on the agenda then. You know, what is it that history as a subject contributes to a pupil's education? Surely it ought to be a compulsory element for Key Stage 2 and Key Stage 3 pupils. Should it be being whittled away from option columns for GCSE and so on? And in any case, what's going to happen to GCSE? You know, there are all sorts of imponderables in it. I'm sorry, I'm meandering. What are your views on its impact on the teaching of history? Well, it had a short-term impact. Certainly, I mean, people had to attune themselves to teaching according to its tenets. It's essential contribution, I think, was that it did rationalise. It did contribute profoundly, I think, to an educational debate that was going on at the time about the nature of the relationship between skills and content. It did encapsulate a theory of history teaching as well as a programme for work. And argue the case for a broad church for history teaching, which I think will stand the test of time. I think it's something that people are going to have to think about whenever the whole subject of history teaching in schools comes up for, and in universities for that matter, comes up for discussion.
Thanks very much.